Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Finny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening pleasure of the Five Eyes Network, who just can't get a job doing anything useful with themselves for a change. Gentlemen, welcome. My very special guest joining me today is none other than Christopher Bolin from Bolin.com, and much like the dude... Just let's go bowling. All right. So can you please, Chris, give us a little bit of background on yourself and what it is you do?
Yeah. Nice to be with you. I'm a journalist. I was an investigative journalist working in Washington, D.C. Starting in 2000. And so when 9/11 happened, I'd been on a job for about a year or so, about a year and a half. And it hit me right where I was most prepared to work on the story. I had done a lot of research on government cover-ups, mass atrocities that were covered up for political reasons, and 9/11 was all of the above. And so I began investigating it by analyzing what was being left out of the narrative that was presented to the people. And that narrative was prepared. A false narrative was given to the American people, to the world, that was designed to take us to war. And that's where we've been for the last 17 years.
I think just this morning, actually, I was watching a video of Jordan Maxwell, and he was talking about how there were so many warning signs in the media and Hollywood and things like that warning up to this, that saying that, oh, my God, they knew what was going to happen beforehand. And he told me something that was very interesting, and I never heard this from one of the elders in the truth movement before, but he said that when 9/11 happened and he saw that his countrymen did not question three buildings turning into dust, he got so depressed that he had to cancel all his talks. He couldn't even speak. He couldn't move. He was so depressed in his own country that they couldn't question that. And that was sort of like powerful for me to have that realization that even somebody who's been studying it for 50 years or whatever, the setup of a new world order and a global government and all of this kind of stuff, would be that impacted by the inaction of others. And I wondered if that similar vein of depression perhaps hit you.
That's interesting. I had not heard that. But it makes a lot of sense because, yes, what happened – and when 9/11 happened, is that we were given this narrative and you had no choice but to accept it. If you did not accept it, you were considered to be an enemy of the state. And people would turn against you and would – I mean, on the very first day it happened, that happened in the evening, I made a comment on 9/11 in a hotel in Pennsylvania on the way home to Chicago. And I commented something like, if we hadn't – you know, something about if our Middle Eastern policy hadn't been so one-sided, this may not have happened. Just questioning, you know, the whole thing. And a person that was watching the TV near me said, you know, 90% of the American people don't agree with you or something like that, so you just better shut up. And this kind of, you know, it touched a nerve. 9/11 touched a nerve, and the narrative we were given was meant to bring our fears to a manageable level and give us an explanation for what had happened, and to make us, you know, it's a very advanced form of using terrorism to psychological effect on a mass level. And you know, the only thing that comes close to it is, you know, World War II, when we had massive you know, horrific things happening to affect an entire population. But this was done by design, and that's what they did. And it brought the entire population of the United States down to this quivering mass where they didn't know what was happening, silent, afraid, like small children. And then they were given this narrative, this folk story, this myth that was meant to capture their rage and corral that rage and that fear into a war against the Muslim world. And that's what we've got.
Indeed, and what's interesting now is that even some of the people who are like some of the progenitors of the quote-unquote 9/11 truth movement have now kind of like backpedaled and go, oh yeah, terrorism's caused by terrorists now. It's not caused by the US government funding random people across the world that they manipulate into fulfilling their agenda for excuses for world domination or anything like that, as they've explained previously in all their documentaries and things like that. No, terrorism's real now. Vote Trump. Fuck me sideways. I was just pissed off, man. It leads me to believe that perhaps there were people in the truth movement who were promoting this kind of thing in a Judas goat type of fashion so that one day they could just turn on all of us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's certainly been the case in a lot of with a lot of people. Because, as I said, this was a mass psychological event, and it was done by very advanced and sophisticated parties who have access to ownership of the media, lots of money, all the money in the world virtually, and using these tools, they meant to, as I said, control and manipulate the population of the world and the United States into war. And so they had the foresight to prepare, as you said, people who would appear to be 9/11 truthers, only to be, you know, at the right time to turn against the people, the movement, to split the movement, to cause dissent, to provide red herring explanations of what happened on 9/11, et cetera, and you know, the thing is to understand is that the war on terror was planned decades before. So the war on terror, we know for sure that the Israelis had designed the Israeli intelligence had designed a war on terror back in the 1970s, and it was being promoted and pushed on the United States and around the world. And when they got 9/11 happened, it was the spark that made that war on terror become operational. And here we are again, like I said, 17 years later. Now I just read a colonel from France who's been involved in the artillery assault on the smallest or the remains of the ISIS people in Syria in the Euphrates River Valley. And what he said is that, that you know, we've been attacking with this artillery and not going in with our armies. We've been using just artillery to bomb this area where these people have been. And by not using the army, we just pounded them and caused a great deal of civilian deaths and infrastructure loss, destruction of infrastructure. And this is what the United States has done in Syria and Iraq for years now. We've just pounded wherever this ISIS went like a moving target. We pounded the area around it, reducing it to rubble and, you know, creating biblical scale destruction. And Raqqa and Mosul were the cities that were done about a year and a half ago, and now we're doing it. You know, we're finishing it up. And this is a French colonel who said, you know, this is just outrageous. This is massive destruction of infrastructure, and that's what we've been doing.
It's funny you should mention that because I saw a photo today of the infrastructure in Syria, or lack thereof. And I thought to myself, hey, that's interesting because the exact same things happened to New Zealand, except instead of the infrastructure being destroyed, we simply sold it and gave control of our strategic assets and essential infrastructure to foreign corporations, right? Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me, whoa, that's Agenda 21 talking. Okay, we want centralization of absolutely everything in an international sovereignty. So you are either going to accept the protocols being done underneath your nose inside your country, or if you reject our overall global agenda, we'll show you what it's like to have your own strategic assets and sovereignty if you don't agree to give them up. We'll just destroy them so you've got nothing, right? Is that about right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw your comment. That's what's happening. That's what's happening. But in the Middle East, you know, we are laying waste and destroying countries willy-nilly in a way that has not happened, you know, even in the Bible times. I mean, we there's a list that's since 9/11 happened. They talked about seven countries in 5 years, and they've It took more than 5 years, but they've done at least 7 countries: Libya, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen. You know, it goes, and many of these countries are, you know, the population is being genocided, like in Yemen. The infrastructure is being completely ravished. I mean, destroyed, like in Libya and Iraq and Syria. And it's like, who's going to rebuild it? What's going to happen to these countries in the future? You know, Libya has been without a functioning government for. Since the NATO went in there a few years, you know, 2011. So it's what's going to happen? I mean, this is such reckless barbarism. I just don't know how the world is going to heal.
Perhaps the whole idea is simply to create a crisis that's so big nobody can understand it, and then come in and propose a solution. You know, world government, no national sovereignty, scumbaggery for all. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that they're talking about war with Iran, or they're talking about war with you know, Russia in Ukraine, and what, you know, it's just that it goes from one crisis to another. They just keep loading, you know, throwing another log on the fire, and you know, it's been terribly wasteful. You know, in the United States of America, for example, the war has cost at least $6 trillion. Trump said 7. And when you account the future costs and, you know, interest, what have you, on the loans, it is that much.
How much if you count the trillions of dollars that went missing the day before 9/11?
Yeah, that was the point. Yeah, right. I mean, you know, and it goes on and on. But that the American people accept this, that they allow this to go on, that they're not protesting in the streets like they are in France, is really unbelievable. But they've only been able to pull it off because of their expertise at controlling the message. And the message has been that we are fighting the bad guys. The bad guys are the terrorists. The terrorists are trying to kill us like they did on 9/11. And therefore, it's a good thing. And that's what the people believe.
If we're not trained in media literacy, and this is another thing, I think I was watching a Jordan Peterson video yesterday, and he says that movies aren't actually the most popular medium for mass communication. And he said that the reason for this is because there's approximately 10 to 20% of the population who have an IQ so low that they couldn't actually follow the narrative of a movie and have it make sense to them. And I thought to myself, That's quite a revelation, because that means that even stupid people can't absorb mass entertainment. And if there's so many of them that they've even noticed this in a phenomenon, what is the likelihood that there's a high enough percentage of the population who are capable of understanding geopolitics and false flag terrorism and this kind of thing? It was quite a frightening and dismal revelation to me, essentially, that there's actually a grand portion of the population who will never be even close to capable of understanding even 1% of the things that you and I are talking about right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, in order to make a change, we only need to reach a critical mass of people of, I don't know if it's 5% or less than 10%. And these are the people that have the intelligence and the wherewithal and the ability and concern to do something, you know, to change things. And this is like what's happening in Paris, France, you know, with the yellow vest, for example. There's a small number of people. But if their protests are effective, that small number of people can change the whole thing. And the same thing in the United States. But in the United States, people are still, even though we have suffered so much loss of money and prestige and whatnot, still, I guess, life is still good enough for many people in America that they don't feel the pinch, and they would rather not put themselves in the uncomfortable situation of actually protesting and discussing the truth. I mean, it's amazing how many people who are very intelligent in America, professors, historians, journalists, whatnot, who refuse to accept or refuse to address 9/11 truth because of the discomfort it would cause them, the discomfort in terms of their job, the psychological discomfort of coming to terms with the hoax of 9/11. that, you know, the entire nation has been lied to for 17 years, and the media is part of it, and a very big part of it, the most important part. You see, in America, when you look at Fox TV or CNN, they don't give you the news anymore. They talk about the key point that they want to talk about for the whole hour. And whether that's something that Donald Trump said or something that Donald Trump did or the wall or whatever the issue is of the day, they will only talk about that one subject for the entire hour, hour after hour after hour. So in this way, they're trying to bring the message to that population, that norm that you talked about, the people who don't have the attention span to or the critical thinking skills to absorb all of this information we're talking about, and they make it a very simple message and repeat it over and over and over again. That's how it works in America now.
Well, that's how it worked in Nazi Germany. I mean, what was it? The propaganda minister said, if you tell a lie, just make sure it's a big one and repeat it often enough and people will believe it.
That's right.
And it seems it's funny, actually, because Trump's campaign manager, his idol, was Hitler's campaign manager. And you just look at their campaign trails, and they're doing the exact same thing. You blame a foreign enemy among you, you make everybody afraid, you tell everybody you've got the solution, and you're financed by a group of extreme bankers. You know?
Right.
Just end of fucking story, ladies and gentlemen. You've got a fascist dictator. And, you know, people don't understand what fascism is. It's when the corporations take over the state. I mean, if you're living in the United States, tell me something. Who do you think is more powerful, the corporations, the state, or are they one and the fucking same? They're one and the fucking same, aren't they, ladies and gentlemen? So what's problematic here is that we don't understand that communism is so similar to the tenets of national socialism that essentially what we've got now is these two flavors, the Republic Communists and the Demo-Nazis, all right? And essentially they try and successfully, mind you, up till this point, to divide people to make sure that this thing called democracy continues to work in America. Now, what democracy means is that somebody with your level of intelligence, Chris, and somebody with my level of intelligence has an equal voting right and an equal voting power as somebody with no intelligence. And the people with no intelligence outnumber the people with intelligence massively. And they don't vote overwhelmingly, which means that the concentrated votes or things like that of stupid people actually are worth more. So if there's 10 possible votes, 9 out of 10 people don't vote, that one person is basically voting with 10 times the power. And because you can convince stupid people to vote in a rigged system a lot more readily than you can intelligent people, it turns out that you get really stupid decisions when it comes to who's running the country. You know, and I think that's not a fucking accident.
Right. Well, it's also that they own the system. They own the system to the point that the people who are presented to the American public to vote upon in election year are selected, very carefully selected. And if they're not selected, if they're not members of the in-group, they get no media coverage at all. So that was when, you know, with Donald Trump, when people talked about him being an accidental candidate, I found that a little hard to believe because he had 24-hour coverage on Fox News, Rupert Murdoch's news corporation, and Murdoch himself is a very strange entity, having come to the United States in the 1980s and buying up newspapers and TV stations across the country, as if they were, you know, as if they were free. And so when the first Gulf War happened, he owned 160 newspapers across the English-speaking world, and all of his editors agreed with Rupert Murdoch on the need to go to war with Iraq in 2003, although there was no evidence of any reason to go to war with Iraq, and the war, as we know from the Chilcot Inquiry in Britain, was an act of aggression. All of his editors of those 160 newspapers agreed with him on the need to go to war. Likewise, this is the man, Rupert Murdoch, who pushed Donald Trump all the time. And then they created a schism in the United States by putting – Fox News was pushing Trump and CNN was pushing Hillary. And that's the way it's been, You know, that's the game they're playing. And this game is to basically create a divide in the American, you know, body politic, and then subdivides and subdivides and subdivides to, you know, to fractionalize the population in the same way that they did to the people of Iraq, for example. You know, you create hostile camps, then you inflame tension between them, whether it's based on race or religion or political differences, whatever. And, like, you know, they get people at each other's necks. And that's what we have today. They're trying to actually destroy the American Republic by using the same tactics that they applied in Iraq.
When you mentioned, are these people part of the in-groups before they become presidents, two entities came to mind, AIPAC and the CFR. You know, AIPAC's the Jewish lobby, right? The Anti-Defamation League or something like that.
And AIPAC is American Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's the lobby for Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I heard somebody say something along the lines of, if you don't get an AIPAC super PAC, you ain't becoming president. You ain't getting no coverage. You ain't going to raise any more money. You ain't going to be invited to any goddamn fundraisers. Like, that's numero uno. You either sign over to them or you ain't going anywhere.
But now we have Sheldon Adelson, too, on top of that. The AIPAC is the lobby, the Israeli lobby. And, of course, you have to be bend over backwards to please them. But then there's Sheldon Adelson, this gambling millionaire from Macau. He's a Jewish guy who's married to an Israeli woman. And he is he comes forward with cash, you know, huge amounts of money for these candidates. He supported Mitt Romney back 4 years ago, 6 years ago, and said he would give $100 million to get Romney into the White House. He's also a big supporter of Donald Trump. And so we have big, big, powerful Zionist money controlling the candidates and who will become a candidate. So, you know, we have our political establishment in America is so obsequious to Netanyahu, to Israel, to what Israel does, and supports it blindly, that we have become basically the warrior state for Israel. We become the Spartans to fight for Israel. I mean, when we look at what's happening in Iraq and Syria, the destruction of these two countries is being done exactly per the Israeli plan to dominate the region. It's called the Yenon plan. And the first two targets of the Yenon plan were Iraq and Syria, in that order. That's exactly what's happened. And so when you look at the United States and France and Britain pounding these Sunni towns like Raqqa and Mosul and the one that's in the Euphrates River now, where they've destroyed in the last few months, all the destruction of infrastructure, it's being done to advance an Israeli agenda. There is no American interest in destroying Syria, for example, none. So when you understand that this is all being done by Zionist-controlled candidates, by Zionist-controlled parties, to the benefit of the Zionist agenda, then it makes sense.
Yeah. In fact, I was just looking up the definition of obsequious while you're saying that, and it's basically being servile, all right, which means having or showing an excessive willingness to serve or please others. Now, this is something that just sort of occurred to me while you were speaking, because the word obsequious popped into my mind this morning while I was having my breakfast. Obsequious. I've been hearing that a lot. What is this? Okay. All right, because I was coming up with a lot of insults that involved the term son of a bitch, you know, and what kind of adjective you could put before the term son of a bitch that would be the most funny. And I found obsequious son of a bitch really fit the key, because we're talking about people here that have essentially lost any and all personal choice and freedom. And I think the exercising of one's conscience is precisely the point of life. Okay, if you don't exercise your own conscience, you're not really alive, I don't think. I think if you are completely servile and have that obsequious nature about you, to have an agenda, and it's so much above you, and oh, I love it, it's so nice, oh, it's beautiful. No, there's something fucking wrong with you, bro. You're part of a cult, okay? You're part of a cult. And then you get the political candidates who have other agendas. You know, Trump comes out and says, you know, straight up in public, I'm the most pro-Israel candidate that has ever been. And people go, oh, yeah, he's going to serve America. He's going to make America great again. He just said who his priority is. Okay. He just said that. Why aren't you saying this? And then you go into the CFR, which I mentioned before, Council on Foreign Relations. And I believe G. Edward Griffin exposed this too long ago, maybe back in 2008, a presentation he did relating to the Quigley formula. And essentially what it does is you only get invited into the group if you've got a certain amount of power and influence. You only go up the chain within the group if you're servile enough. And you only get given the opportunities to lead if you're part of those groups in the first place, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that happened as soon as Trump got elected. I did an article called, inspired by Mark Passio, "Congratulations, Order Followers. Trump's administration is full of New World Order puppets and dark occultists." And what I did is, you know, I didn't follow the election at all, Chris. I'm ashamed to say, because I thought it was fucking pointless. Because what everybody promises during the campaign, I think I learned over 10 years of watching campaigns that it doesn't fucking matter what they say during the campaign. What matters is who they appoint directly after winning said campaign. Who did he appoint? Mm-hmm. A whole bunch of Freemasons, dark occultists, and CFR and Trilateral Commission members. And I was like, boom, you've all been had. Okay, you know, it was just that fucking simple for me. And yet there is a cognitive dissonance, a denial out there that the truth movement denial of the betrayal of Trump is probably something that vexes me most.
Wait, say that again. What about the truth movement betrayal? I mean, can you spell that out for me a bit?
Well, what it means is if you're part of a truth movement, it means that truth is your center point, okay? And if you've been lied to, you stop supporting those liars. That's what having the truth, and that's what having integrity, and that's what having intelligence, really, in this game is truly about. And I was incredibly upset at just how many people who I thought who had integrity just didn't. You know, but what was problematic?
But not vis-a-vis Trump. Not involved with Trump. You mean, or is it because?
Does
Trump fit into this?
It was that too. Yeah. It was specifically the pro-Trumpers. Now, I'm not going to be insulting or anything like that, because I realized something is that I've been part of companies and I didn't know who was running that company. I've been, I've done things and I didn't quite understand what I was doing. I mean, let's say, for example, I think a businessman's a slave. Does he think he's a slave? No, he probably doesn't. So I go up to him and I say, hey, bro, you don't think you're a slave, right? And he goes, no, I don't think I'm a slave. I'm not serving some kind of fascist agenda. And I go, okay, what's at the top of your shirt there around your neck? It's a collar. Okay. What's around your wrists on the end of your jacket? Those are cuffs. And what's that around your throat? It's a leash. So you think you're free and you're not a slave, and you've got a collar around your neck, cuffs around your wrists, and a leash around your throat. Okay? Now, he hadn't thought about that. And a deeper realization comes to this is that even people who are part of the CFR and Trilateral Commission and any organization, whether they be Truth Movement affiliated or not, there's a good possibility that they have no idea what they're a part of. And I think that goes for all of us, as we believe a lot of things that we don't actually really know. And then when somebody comes with new information that contradicts what we know, it really doesn't help if they come with that information and an accusation. You're in on it. You're an agent or something like that. Like, I'll say things that were incorrect on my broadcast a couple of years back or something like that. And then somebody will come up and correct me and then say, ha ha, you must be an agent now or something like that. When in actual fact, I was just wrong. And I admitted that I was wrong and moved the fuck on as we're supposed to do.
Well, you know, the thing about Donald Trump is that he said during his campaign, at one point he said, if I'm elected president, you'll find out who took down the towers. And that was enticing, obviously, to anybody who's a truther. But the thing is that the truth movement is so marginalized in America, in the world, because this secret organization that you're talking about, the powers, the Masonic levels, and the people that control our media, our universities, our churches, that this network is so pervasive that it can that is able to keep the 9/11 truth movement ostracized for 17 years. That's what really boggles my mind. It's the same sort of thing like, like chemtrails. You know, people, you can I was on top of a mountain the other day, clear blue sky, until of course the chemtrails were working in one part of the sky. Really, really egregious, blatant chemtrails, huge, very obvious. But I ask, you know, yeah, I might ask a person who's looking at them and say, what do you think about that? Is that normal to you? And they said, those are just condensation trails. And you can point out, well, look at it. It went there and stopped there for a while and it started again. Did the plane turn off the engine? But, you know, it's the same sort of thing. It's the same sort of thing with 9/11, is that people who are given the narrative, who will accept the narrative given by the government, as long as they have faith and trust that government and that media. And that's where the big divide happens, because when you look at the evidence of 9/11, or you look at the evidence of chemtrails, but when you look at the evidence of 9/11, you will quickly come to the conclusion, you know, using your critical thinking, that the government and media have been lying to us for 17 years. And that is a jump that most people are simply not comfortable making. They're not comfortable making that leap from trusting in the government like their parents and trusting the media, to understanding that the government media are lying to us. And not just about little things like, you know, taxes or something like that. They're lying to us about the murder of 3,000 people in broad daylight in New York City 17 years ago, and the wars that were being fought, that had been fought in the wake, in the aftermath of that, and going on now for 17 years. So they're plundering the country, killing our youth and the people of other countries, and, you know, taking our country and other countries into the gutter. And the people in the country are still afraid to stand up and say, wait, there's something wrong here.
Mm. I think that fear is well founded. All right. There's so many people who have lost their gig because they just came out as against 9/11 or against chemtrails or anything like that. It's the old phrase, really, in an insane world, a sane man must appear insane. And who wants to employ insane people? Okay, so here's the thing. To not become a truth movement member, you know, to go out and really tell the truth all the time about everything, you know, that kind of thing, is perfectly understandable, because your finances at stake, that'll affect your family,
right.
It'll affect your life,
right.
It'll give you depression, it'll give you anxiety, it'll fucking destroy your life. Okay, so, join the truth movement, everybody, ladies and gentlemen. You'll get fucking depressed, lose everything you have of value, and have no...
right.
And, you know, it's just like, we don't have any fucking advertising appeals for this kind of fucking nonsense,
right.
Do we,
you know? That's exactly right. You hit it on the head. And you know, there is nothing to really be gained for people who are practical, sensible, like you said. This is a decision is very easily made that, no, I will not risk my pension, my position. I will simply go along with this for the rest of my working life and maybe beyond that, and accept whatever comes. But that attitude, oh my God, if we all accepted that, if we all just went along with that, there's no end to what they would do. There's no end to, you know, what the bad guys would do. You know, at least there's a small group of people who have sacrificed all those things you talked about. I'm one of them, and you know, try to stand up against it, because it means more to us that there be truth, that the truth prevail, that the truth come out.
It's knighthood I've been looking into a bit lately, and the concept of chivalry. And I think it was King Arthur in the legend was asked, what is the most valuable quality of a knight? Is it his honor? Is it his virtue? And it turns out that it was truth. Truth was the most valuable concept of being a knight. Now, knighthood is something that has been corrupted for a long time. So once upon a time, a boy would become a man over a long period of time. Now, in New Zealand, we've got this 21st year tradition where you drink a lot of beer out of what they call a yard glass. Okay, so you're now a man. All right. So the concept of having honor, having integrity, and integrity, ladies and gentlemen, it means to tell the truth and behave with a moral conscience at all times, all times. Mm-hmm. So it means that you cannot lie and you cannot do any of these things, otherwise you lose your integrity. And for some people, their integrity is simply not worth losing, because ultimately, when everything else in this world is taken from you, integrity is the only thing that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And people well have said. Forgotten this, right? And when you live in a world with people who do not act with honor, they do not behave with true care, there are two things that can happen to you. Number one, you treat yourself as an example to others, and you actually feel good about the fact that you're not behaving like everybody else, that you are being better than even yourself, right? I did a song with the boys a while ago, and one of the lyrics, though, is saying that being better than yourself is not enough, okay? And what that lyric means is that no matter how much you improve yourself, it is never going to be good enough. You always must continuously improve who you are and what you do along the plane of existence. Because if you do not, you stagnate, you get depressed, and you essentially stop doing what you're doing. And the benefits of what you're doing get denied everybody. And that's the obligation behind doing things like campaigning for truth, justice, integrity, reality itself, is that other people will lose their touch with reality entirely if people like us did not exist. That is the inherent obligation. If we do not do what it is we are doing, we may lose everything, and so will everybody else. Now, when faced with that choice, it is not a choice. However, most people are not aware that they have that choice. That's what's
very good. Very, very well said. That's very interesting, and very true.
How did you personally?
That's absolutely true.
How did you personally actually come across this? I mean, one of my friends, Evelyn Gilbert, she used to work in special effects on movies and things like that when she was living in Holland, and then when the towers came down, she immediately saw that there was something wrong with this kind of thing. Did you immediately have an inkling that something was wrong, or?
The things happened that day that didn't make sense. The buildings obviously were being exploded because the material was being thrust sideways. I mean, anybody could see that that was not a collapse, but that was a highly energetic explosions that were going off in the middle of the building. There were several other things, but in the very beginning, I began questioning that very thing, that explosions in the building, for example. In the first day, there were a lot of people who talked about these. Hundreds of firefighters and people who were in the buildings talked about it. It was written up in newspapers or in magazine like People. People magazine had three survivors talk about explosions. The BBC, I think his name was Stephen Evans, was at Building 2. He talked about the series of explosions he saw that day. It was broadcast on the first day, but never again. So we could see that there were certain aspects of 9/11 that were being omitted from the narrative completely. Explosions and then Israeli involvement. And just working on those two components, that was the beginning of my search. And yeah, you know, I had seen similar cover-ups before in Europe, in the United States, Flight 800. TWA Flight 800 a couple years earlier. The final hearings were one year earlier than 9/11, when they basically said that the plane just – a spark, you know, may have caused the explosion in the central fuel tank, and down the plane went. When there were 100 people who saw a missile streak from the ocean go up to the plane and explode over the left wing. The eyewitness testimony was completely ignored in the final hearing by the NTSB, the Traffic Safety Board. And ignored completely. And so I said, wow, that was in August 2000, I think it was. I said, if the government can do a cover-up of such a thing so blatantly, I said, this country is in a lot of trouble. And then also I had for years and years studied Israeli crimes, Israeli actions and crimes and wars and aggression, and the relationship with the United States of America, how the Zionist narrative, the Zionist explanation was always given preference over anything else, even the facts that people could see with their own two eyes. And that's what 9/11 was all about. You know, we had this thing happened, this atrocity happened. People can see with their own eyes exactly what did happen. And we're told, no, that's not what you think it is. That's 19 Arabs from Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia did all that. And you know, there are certain aspects that are just clearly contradictory to that narrative, like the molten metal. There was tons and tons of molten iron, molten metal before, during, and after the collapses of the towers. And that alone puts the entire official version to bed. It cannot exist. It cannot be true, because there's no explanation for what would have produced all that molten metal, other than, you know, something like thermite, something that was put in the building and is part of the destruction. So that's the thing, is that it was very clear. And as I began investigating more and more, this aspect and that aspect, I found that the entire thing was a cover-up, a deception. And the cover-up is where you were able to find who was really behind it. And at every single point of the saga, I found that it was either a Zionist agent of the State of Israel or an Israeli himself making this key decision that allowed this deception to go ahead.
You know, that reminds me of an interview that I did with one of the USS Liberty survivors. And we came to the point during the interview where I had a profound realization. He talked about how he was really confused by the Israeli planes flying over and attacking the ship. You know, they were waving to them, they were sunbathing and everything like that, and all of a sudden they start shooting. That wasn't what traumatized him. What traumatized him is when he came home and the government covered it up. It wasn't being attacked by somebody who was your friend. It was coming home and being betrayed by somebody who had employed you. You know, that kind of thing that traumatized him for life. And I thought that was particularly interesting, because as a New Zealander, I had no real tie to the American consciousness, or at least not at that time when 9/11 happened. I think I was like 15, I think. And a friend of mine comes into the hall and says, "Hey, did you see the Twin Towers got taken out last night?" And I was like, what? You know, like confused. School basically shut down for that day. We sat in the history teacher's room watching those towers come down again and again and again and again. And it's only in retrospect, maybe like 10, 15 years later, that I recognize, oh, that was a mind control technique, a mass mind control technique. I've been told it and shown it so many times. It was collapse. Boom, 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 boom. It was collapse. Boom, 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 boom. It was collapse. Boom, 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 boom. And all of a sudden, my question, Chris, is, when you did discover this, what was the kind of public backlash that you actually wound up having to go through? Because when you tell an uncomfortable truth to people who have essentially a mind control program running in their mind, you kind of get that cognitive dissonance where you get the aggression, the denial, the unacceptance, the even abuse and punishment because of your perceived slight of their God, which was their belief.
I was a journalist working for a weekly paper in Washington called the American Free Press, and I was allowed to write whatever I wanted basically about 9/11, and I was very careful in my research and my writings and what I said. And but it was from the very beginning I was pointing out that this could have been an Israeli false flag operation, and I was attacked for that article about eyewitness testimony of explosions at the World Trade Center, which was one of the first articles I wrote. I was I and the newspaper were attacked by the Anti-Defamation League. They attacked – they said I was writing something like grist for the anti-Semitic mill, something like that. And you know, our newspaper, which was in Washington, did not sue the ADL for that comment, which they should have done. They didn't, because there's nothing anti-Semitic about what I said. But so for the first year, couple of years, I didn't have any problem with writing or talking about it. And the thesis was developing. I've written a book called Solving 9/11, The Deception Changed the World. That book was only written in 2012. But the articles that I wrote are in a larger volume called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. And there I present the articles for the first 11, 12 years in chronological order. So the reader can read how this hypothesis developed and became a thesis, because at a certain point the evidence was overwhelming that you know, you can't have it any other way, that you can't have when it looks like a Zionist operation, it smells like a Zionist operation, and the evidence indicates it is, well, it probably is. And but I kept, you know, I kept it at that level, that this may be, probably, it was very careful. And it wasn't until 2006, when I was attacked by undercover police at my house, that I realized that, you know, I couldn't get away with, I couldn't write anymore in the United States.
Can you elaborate on that? You got attacked by secret police at your house?
Undercover police, undercover tactical police. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this was in 2006, and you see what had happened that year, just a few months prior, was that we had basically pinpointed and discovered that nanothermite, or that thermite, involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I worked with Stephen Jones at Brigham Young at BYU in Provo. Mm. And I had gone out to California, and I had discovered that the smoke that rose from the pile for 3 months was very, very hot. It was like a thin blue smoke. And there was only one drum, one device testing the smoke that rose from the pile. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, the head of that agency, Christine Todd Whitman, had told the people of New York that the air was safe to breathe and the water was safe to drink. The air was anything but safe to breathe. The air was very, very – the smoke was laden with nanoparticles. And I spoke to the man at UC Davis, the professor at UC Davis. His name is Thomas Cahill, who had set up that one device on the roof on Varick Street that measured the smoke when the smoke blew through the device. And he said that the smoke was heavily laden, was primarily composed of nanoparticles. These are extremely small particles that are not made in usual fires. And I said, well, I asked Professor Cahill, what would create nanoparticles in the smoke? And he said, only temperatures hotter than the boiling point of the metal involved. So, because it's an aerosol drum, it measures aerosol particles in smoke. And it was interesting that the people at that laboratory in California at UC Davis, they were not comfortable with what this meant. They had the data. The data showed them this, but they weren't comfortable with what that meant. But I wrote an article, Why Did Iron Boil in the Rubble of the World Trade Center? And that was a discovery that was not supposed to happen. The discovery of thermite and nanothermite in the World Trade Center was not supposed to happen. And when it did happen, the powers that are behind this attacked the people who were involved in this discovery, most notably me and Professor Stephen Jones at BYU. We were both, you know, attacked, and he lost his job and his position and all that kind of stuff. And I was attacked by undercover police at my house. And that led to it's a little bit of a long story, but they had been driving around the house for a couple of days in an unmarked car, men wearing body armor, and obviously armed people with body armor. We had no idea who they were. And you have to understand that in the line of work that I'm in, I noticed them driving. I was riding my bike one day by the house, past the house, and I saw this car go by, and I could as I was up on the bicycle, I could see into their car, and I saw that they were three guys, heavily armed, with body armor. And I thought, what are they doing in my neighborhood? It's a quiet residential neighborhood. And then the next night, they drove right past my house. And they leaned out the car doors, and they like were really trying to provoke me in a way. And so I thought, what to do now? And I called this number, 911 number, to report this to the local police. And I said, you know, there's this car going around my house with these guys with body armor. I'd like to know what's going on. And they said, we'll send an officer to your house.
Let me guess. They said, we know.
No, they said, no. They said, we'll send an officer to your house. And what happened was that this tactical unit, they took over the call. And they came to my house, and they marched up the driveway. And were, you know, my wife stopped them, my daughter, and they refused to identify themselves. My wife asked, "Who are you? You know, do you have any identification?" And I saw them out the kitchen window, and I ran out there and I said, "Who are you? What agency are you with? Why are you doing this?" And I turned to go back into the house. They jumped on me. They held me down on the ground. They tasered me. Put a taser on my back and hit me with a taser, and in the process of doing that, they fractured my elbow, and the tasering was awful too. That led to a process that I went to trial, and I resisted their charges. They charged me with attacking them. These are three armed guys coming up my driveway with body armor, and they said I attacked them, and that I resisted their arrest, although they never identified themselves as police in any way, shape, or form. So that led to a trial. A trial is very unusual in America. Usually, cases are settled out of court, or not out of court, but the plea bargain. You accept one. You plead guilty to one, and you accept the penalty as deemed by the judge. I refused to say I was guilty of anything, and so the trial went forward, and it was a completely rigged Chicago trial. My evidence was not allowed. My expert witness was not allowed to testify. The police lied on the stand openly and clearly. It all flew, and so then I realized we had to leave Chicago, so we went to Europe, and I've been in Europe ever since.
That's why you're up so late tonight doing this show.
Yeah, well, you see, that happened then. That was 2007. The trial was, and I realized then that I had to validate my research, because I'd been attacked, obviously, and I had to present my research in a way that people could understand what it was all about. So I began writing the book. I began writing the book, Solving 9/11. And it took me 5 years after all that work and research, and it still took me 5 years to put it together. And it was published in 2012. It's called Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And that book and the original articles book that I told you before, those books have been very important, because they've spelled out the details of who was involved in 9/11 and why it was done. And then to make it, you know, as the war on terror went on and on and on for 17 years, in the summer of 2017, I published a book called The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East, which is a small book, but it explains the relationship between 9/11 and the war on terror. And shows that, again, the same people who brought us 9/11 have brought us a war on terror. And it's all being done for this interest, this foreign interest, the Greater Israel Project. And who's behind that?
I was just thinking something funny about that. It would be good that if the next false flag was actually advertised, much like a movie trailer was, from the people who brought you 9/11 and vaccines and... comes a new false flag, totally you've never seen before.
Yeah.
Use the same fucking playbook every time, you know, that's why all the movies sound the same. I'm sorry for interrupting, go right ahead.
No, and what we find is that yeah, the same people involved, you have the state, that, you know, Israeli military intelligence, they're the ones who are the operational arm, but there is another arm that is the body of the beast, I think resides in London, Paris, it's the Rothschild family, the Rothschild enterprise, the banking, the big banking family. They built Israel, and they control countries like the United States of America with their financial power, the fact they create our money with the Federal Reserve System. and you find many, many people who are involved in 9/11, even like Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu. Before he went back to Israel in 1979 and began pushing the war on terror, he worked for a company in Boston called Boston Consulting, which is a Rothschild company. And you find this with many of the players in 9/11, like the guy who ran the CIA, operational manager of the CIA that day, Buzzy Krongard. Is a fake name, but Buzzy Krongard. His wife works for Rothschild North America. So you find this time and time again. There's this hidden hand that's not very hidden, but it's you know, not right on the surface.
And it's the Rothschild. Mm-hmm. It's not hidden per se. It's an open conspiracy. The beauty of it, though, all right, there's a scene from The Matrix when he goes, "Have you ever just looked at it and marveled at its beauty, its genius? Billions of people living out their lives, oblivious." And I think that's probably the genius of the conspiracy, is that it sounds so fucking ridiculous to somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about that they would immediately dismiss it offhand. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I need to create a Vinnie Eastwood conspiracy, something that's so gargantuan in scope and so fucking ridiculous that it sounds absolutely insane. And then nobody would suspect me of it.
Yeah. But the thing is that you did that very well, is that you don't have the assets. You know, you have to have that immense financial power and political power in order to do something like this. And you have to have control, and you have to have control of the secret societies or the Masonic groups that we're talking about, like B'nai B'rith. And that's what you have. You see, it's like it's conspiracy in a democracy, in a democratic state like America. You wonder how they do it. Well, God, when you drive into an American city, any American town, the first thing you see on the way into town is a marquee, a big sign, "Welcome to Flatville." And on that marquee, there will be all the emblems of all the secret societies in that town.
Same the in
Lions,
New Zealand.
Oddfellows, the Rotary Masons, Club, yeah. The Masons, they're all there. And except B'nai B'rith probably doesn't have a logo out there. I've never seen a B'nai B'rith logo on those marquees.
I've never even heard of that, but all right.
Well, the B'nai B'rith is the key, the spider in the web. It's the one that controls all the other ones, because it's only open to men who are Jewish and Zionist, but they can belong to other societies. So it's a super privileged group, and that allows them. You know, in the old days when people passed away, men of stature, that they would write at the bottom of their obituary all the secret societies they belong to. They don't do that anymore, but they used to do that. So you'd see that this man belonged to B'nai B'rith, but he also belonged to Rotary and many others. And you know, that gave them the power to conspire within one group to affect the other groups, control the other groups. And these Masonic groups are Zionist by nature. So that you have – and the same thing in America. We have these churches that are so-called Christian churches, but they are completely Zionist in their belief system. They believe that to be a Christian, a good Christian, they have to support the state of Israel. And that is a huge number of people. We have like 50 million Christian Zionists in America. And these are the people that support George Bush. And these are the people who supported Donald Trump. And these are the people who support the war on terror.
And they're also, according to the statistics, some of the highest IQ people in the world. So you know,
I'm not sure about that.
Oh well.
I think a lot of them belong to the first group you talked about earlier.
Well, I'm sure a lot of them do. But how IQ works, it works out on tail end. So, for example, if you've got twice as many geniuses as any other racial group, or depending on where you're raised and that kind of thing. But they did this whole racial IQ thing, and it's like, okay, Ashkenazi Jews on average highest IQ, like 115, which is only one standard differential away from the rest of the population that live in the United States, kind of thing. So it's not a huge difference, but however, when you have one standard differential away from the average population, you become dramatically more intelligent, and your power base is very, very different in scope and scale and how much influence you can have, because it's one of those greater predictors of success in a dynamic environment. Now, what that means is if you have a job like mine where it changes all the time, you got to come into new information, you got to have new people, and nothing stays the same, essentially, you require high IQ to do that job. However, if your job is incredibly simple, or rather it's regimented, it doesn't really change, you just kind of got to do the same thing, the higher your IQ, the quicker you'll be able to learn that job, and the quicker you'll get bored from doing it. You know, and I thought that was actually quite an interesting diagnosis there, because there's a possibility. I'm not saying that this is the case, but it was just a thought that occurred to me. I mean, I think it was Jordan Peterson that actually said this, these statistics and stuff like that, and I believe they've been backed up by Stefan Molyneux as well. What is it about Canadians and racial IQ obsession? I don't know. But the thing is, if you do actually have a group of people, like, as you said, there's a Jewish Zionist specific group that is hard above the rest, and if that specific group actually has, on average, one standard deviation higher IQ than the rest, then it might actually explain why they're actually so powerful now in this dynamic, changing environment of geopolitics.
Well, just we're talking about some of the things here. We've mixed up a few things here. I was talking about B'nai B'rith. And B'nai B'rith is a Jewish Zionist group, but their real power is that they're secret. They're secret, which allows them to conspire in a democratic state. So that, for example, when these B'nai B'rith guys from New York City, when they meet, when Lodge Number One gets together and has a powwow, you have the publisher of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and You have all the publishers, you have all the heads of all of the power sources in New York City meeting in one room. You see? And the same thing in Los Angeles or Miami or Chicago or wherever. And what they say, what they talk about in behind closed doors does not get out. And so they're able to, you know, talk to Mr. Murdoch or talk to Mr. Sulzberger and say, you know, we're going to do it. And it's interesting that, you know, there were some things happened on, after 9/11, that, like the guy that owned CNN, he quit. He just quit the next day. He just got up and he left the job. Well, Mr. Levin, he left a few weeks after 9/11. He just didn't want to go with it. He didn't want to be any part of it to do with it. His son had been killed a few years earlier, and I guess he just didn't want it. He had no stomach for it. Then the guy that ran Deutsche Bank, the head of Deutsche Bank, left the next day, the very next day. Deutsche Bank was the bank that was just on the periphery of the 9/11 Ground Zero area.
Weren't they?
It was a large.
Weren't they the bank that actually had all those put options and everything like that?
I don't know how many put options they had. They may have been involved in some of that. That was Alex Brown Bank in Baltimore. They were heavily involved in that, and that had been previously headed, controlled by the man that ran the CIA on 9/11, Buzzy Krongard, who we talked about earlier. An interesting thing happened at the Deutsche Bank, is that when the attacks began, they noticed that their computer system was taken over by an outside force, their entire computer network, and all of their files were just like instantly sucked out of their network, and they had lost all control of their computer, and all the data was taken away, just like that. So something, you know, 9/11 had a lot of strange things happening, but that was one of them. And somebody had the night before, as we know, gone into the vaults beneath Building 6, for example, and absconded with all the gold and criminal evidence. The vaults had been cleaned out the night before, so it was a crime within a crime within a crime. It was a massive crime, and you know, what became very clear to me after 9/11 was that there would be no criminal investigation. There would be no investigation at all. And the destruction of the evidence began in the very first hour after 9/11 happened. They began destroying the evidence. Well, come on. This is a crime scene where 3,000 people have been killed. You don't just start destroying the evidence. But the government, the Bush government, declared it to be an act of war. And by declaring it to be an act of war, that precluded the need for any investigation. So they destroyed the evidence. I said, this is clearly wrong. And because it was so obviously wrong, I began, you know, investigating it on my own.
Yeah. What did it feel like to, I mean, we all come to that point where we realize, okay, we now actually have to do this on our own. Nobody else is going to fulfill our dreams for us. What I did is immediately I reduced all of my costs. So I was like, okay, mm-hmm. I can't live in a fancy place. I can't have a fancy car. I can't have a cell phone that has a plan and all of this kind of thing. Just reduced all my costs down so that I could spend pretty much all my fucking time exposing scumbaggery, mm-hmm. you know. But mm-hmm. I think it wasn't just my commitment to the cause that I think was most important. I mean, sure, each individual contribution to the greater whole is essentially what makes the whole, and there is nothing less. However, I realized something very important as a young man, that I needed elders, mentors, particularly men, to show me what the virtues were of being intelligent, of being a researcher, of having integrity as a journalist. And in saying that, I was wondering, did you have any such men in your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. My father was had studied journalism at university after World War II when he came back. And he was my first proofreader, my first editor. And I actually began journalism in high school. But again, there my career didn't last that long because I wrote about school bus safety. And that was like the buses were not – these big yellow buses we ride around in American schools are very unsafe. But then I went on, and when I began doing my research as a journalist, I started in 2000. Then there were some people. One of my mentors was a scientist at Lawrence Livermore Lab in California, retired scientist. He was a man who worked on the Manhattan Project. He was a nuclear scientist, and he had developed he had made all these things work. Manhattan Project, all the way through to Star Wars under Ronald Reagan. Which was when he retired from his position, but he was concerned. He still lived in the area, Livermore, and he was concerned about the dangers of radiation to the public, and he taught me about the particle effect and other things. But the particle effect, I worked on this in the context of the depleted uranium munitions that are being used in the war these days, which are extremely toxic. When America goes to war, whether it's in Yugoslavia or in Iraq, they have cannons and tanks and artillery that fire depleted uranium shells, which are basically armor piercing. They'll go right through a tank like a knife through butter. And you know, these are used all the time now, and they're extremely harmful to anybody who lives in the area and the environment. It will be affected for a long, long time. But he taught me about the particle effect, which is when a depleted uranium shell hits something like a tank, about half of its mass becomes a cloud of gas. And that gas is dispersed. And if you're a person who happens to come into contact with that cloud of gas and the particles that are in that cloud, you're going to be very sick. You will get very, very sick and die in a pretty short life. And the Pentagon, of course, denied all of this. Marion Falk, my mentor in California, he taught me about the particle effect. And that's exactly the same thing we're talking about with the smoke that rose from the World Trade Center, is that you have, not in this case uranium, but a bunch of other things that are cooking at extremely hot temperatures, hotter than the temperature of boiling iron, and producing these very, very small particles that are then in the smoke. And we had thousands of people working on the pile, firefighters and first responders, what have you. And these people had no protection, although there's no protection you can have for such small particles. And they were inhaling the smoke, you know, day in and day out. And now we have tens of thousands of sick New Yorkers who are dying of cancer and lymphoma, what have you. And we just found out recently that the fund that was established to compensate these people is running out of money, so that now, as the number of people increases, the funding has gone away, so that there are many people who have been exposed to these toxic gas from the World Trade Center who will not get any money at all.
Well, I think somebody actually commented in the chat room earlier on in the show that there aren't any more cases against the World Trade Center and stuff like that because all the people are now dead, the first responders and things like that. I don't know how true that statement was.
The wrongful death cases of the victims of the people of the people who died on 9/11, the first 3,000 people, the families who lost loved ones on the planes or in the towers, they've been settled out of court. They've been all settled out of court. But the
all of them,
the people who the people all there were 3,000 fatalities on 9/11, and those families have all been settled out of court. None of them ever went to court. Not a single one ever went to trial. The first 2,900 were basically settled in the compensation fund that the government gave them, in which they accepted the payment and then signed away any right to litigate further. There were 96 families left. Those 96 families wanted to have the case in court, the day in court. They held out, and one by one, they were settled out of court until there was no one left standing. Okay, but then what we're talking about here with these other first responders. This is a group of thousands of people. These are the firefighters. These are the people that were exposed to the contamination at the site or in the smoke thereof. And this number keeps growing because some people are just coming down with the sicknesses now. You see cancers and other problems that they're caused by their exposure to this debris or to the smoke. And this is the group of people that we're going to talk about now, and they're the ones who are not going to be getting 50% or 30% of the funds that they should be getting to compensate for their loss. They're very, very sick people, and they've been dying in droves, thousands of people. It's not talked about in the mainstream media very often, except like when it came up last week that the fund was being cut, the fund is running out of money. They only have a little bit of money, and they've got hundreds of people signing up all the time. It's a public health crisis of the first degree for New York City. And this is where, these people should be suing the EPA. I would think, I'm not a lawyer, but they would have a case to sue because the administrator of the EPA said the air was safe to breathe. And that gave people a kind of false confidence to go out and walk around in Lower Manhattan when walking around Lower Manhattan could be, fatal to your health.
Well, I was also thinking about this in terms of the dust particles that come out of DU shells when they hit their targets and things like that, turning into all this massive things. Imagine what that does when you fire them in a fucking desert, all right? And it mixes with all the goddamn sand where everybody lives and walks in, and sand blows by the wind. It's just, God, everywhere. Wouldn't that cause like a quarter of all Iraqi children to be born deformed after the second Iraq invasion? Why, yes. Yes, it did.
Right. That's right. That's right, and it's also the cause of a lot of the birth defects that Americans had when they came back. Life magazine did a photo essay about that. Must have been early 90s after the first Gulf War. It was awful. It was awful because this depleted uranium, the particle effect, it gets into your. The reason why the particles are so deadly is that they're so small. They're nano size. Is that they pass through every tissue in your body. They pass through your lungs and the flesh, and they don't stop until they lodge into the nucleus of the cell. They lodge themselves into the nucleus of the cell, where all of the data and the chromosomes and the DNA are there to be affected. And so that's why they create such hideous sicknesses and birth defects. That's the particle effect. And that's what that mentor who taught me about depleted uranium. That's what he taught me. And people like Marion Falk, who have really done a great deal simply by sharing the information that they knew, their scientific knowledge, to a journalist like myself. And as I said, when I called the Pentagon many times about this, Pentagon always had a standard, denial. No, there's nothing harmful about depleted uranium. It's nothing to worry about. And they just lie through their teeth, but that's what they're paid to do. They're paid to lie to cover up.
Well, it's funny. You were talking about how you had to learn the science and stuff like that, because yesterday I was thinking to myself, wait a second, I'm not just a journalist, and journalists aren't just journalists. What do I mean by that? It means that in order to explain in context to somebody what something means, you have to be an engineer for a little bit. and talk to an engineer, learn what they know, understand it, and then be able to put that information out there. If you're talking to a doctor or something like that, you have to put your doctor hat on as a journalist. And I thought to myself, isn't that one of the most interesting and perhaps even one of the most valuable services that journalists provide society, is to give people with no technical understanding an abridged version that they can comprehend. Essentially, it's essentially we shortcut a lot of the work that we personally have to do for others so that they don't actually have to really do so much digging and researching and what have you in order to figure out that what we're saying is absolutely true.
Right. That's a good point. This learning about nanotechnology was very important for me because a few years later, in 2009, Professor Stephen Jones finally came out with his paper, this study, where they showed that nanothermite had been involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And this is a form of thermite. You know, thermite is a usual incendiary mixing ferrous iron oxide, like rust powder, with aluminum. And it's usually mixed like sand, and it's used to, you know, weld railroad ties together, things like that. It was used in the bombing of Dresden. Incendiaries that were used when they bombed German cities were thermite sticks. But in this case, it's made using nanotechnology. So you're taking the reacting particles and reducing them to a size of nano size, and then you have something of a quite a different beast. You have something that it reacts many times faster with a great deal of energy. And this is what was used on 9/11. There were other things used. There were traditional explosives used. There may have been dirty bombs used. Some people think nuclear was used. I don't think nuclear was used. Either does Marion Falk. But certainly this stuff was used. And at a temperature of like 400 degrees, it went off with a bang and produced extreme heat, explosion, and a tiny ball of iron with some aluminum in it. And that is the characteristic of the smoke of 9/11. The signature characteristic of the smoke of 9/11 are these tiny balls of iron. Signature characteristic means that if the dust particles that are brought to you, if you get some dust and somebody says this is dust from the World Trade Center, if it does not contain those little tiny iron balls, it's not from the World Trade Center because it's ubiquitous. It's in every single sample. And so then in 2009. That was the final nail in the coffin of the official version, that it could not possibly be true. There's no way that Osama bin Laden and his 19 Arabs could have put nanothermite into the World Trade Center. You know, so it was like the planes flying into the building were the first act that was meant to lead the viewer into thinking that, oh, when the buildings fell down, the planes made it happen. A plus B equals C, but that's not the case at all. The planes flew into the building, that was a distraction, and the destruction of the building was done by a completely other agent, not by jet fuel at all. Jet fuel had nothing to do with bringing down the World Trade Center. The World Trade Center was blown up using nanothermite and other things.
It seems that when you're talking about nanothermite and what have you, to a lot of people in the truth movement, this is absolutely, you know, of course. But then, of course, you got other people within the truth movement who are saying other things. You know, I believe Jim Fetzer, former Marine commander, saying that there were mini and micro nukes possibly deployed. What was his name? Dmitry Khalazov. He claimed that the Kursk, the sunk Russian sub that sunk not too long before 9/11 had missing Tomahawk cruise missiles. They were anti-aircraft carrier cruise missiles that were supposed to fly along the waterline and then hit them right down the bottom, claiming that that's what hit the Pentagon. And then you've got what's her name, Judy Wood saying there were directed energy weapons and things of that nature that sucked all the energy out from the cyclone that was this hurricane that was off the coast that was off the coast of the United States that nobody reported on apparently, and then it just disappeared and all that energy just go. and do all this, right? So the point I'm making here is that there's multiple different theories and things like that about what goes in. Now, the reason why the OSS, which later became the CIA, was created in World War II was to sow confusion among the enemy, period. That was the only reason for their fucking existence. And I believe that this exact same goddamn tactic of confusing the enemy being us, has been deployed by multiple agents throughout the truth movement and things like that to get us all fighting with each other, accusing and that kind of thing, and arguing about these details, whereas you're talking about the actual real facts. These are the evidence. This is the samples. This is the shit that we fucking got. You know, that kind of thing.
That's so, right. Very well said. That's exactly what's been going on. We call it the function of an agent. Agents that are in the movement are to sow dissent. So suspicion and dissent. You know, they, for example, they attack me personally. They'll say, "Oh, he's this, he's done that." And, you know, they make stories up about you. So they attack. If they can't attack what you say, they attack the messenger. But the whole point is that you have to divide the truth movement, and in order to do so, you have to create very elaborate false red herrings. A red herring to take people in a certain direction, and then when you create a red herring, then you have to puff it up and blow it up and give it a lot of credit.
We could first please just define the word red herring for the audience.
Yeah, red herring is it's an old hunting term from Europe, but they would take a smoked herring and it was used to lead the hunters, the dogs, in a wrong path. So it's to take you on a false trail that you think that you're going after, you know, it's to mislead people into a false direction, and the red herring was used in some way to take the people off the right path and take them on another path, the false path. And you know, I've heard these theories you talked about before. People encouraged me to look at the book by Judy Wood. And I did. I had a chance to look at it. And her book, for example, came out 1 year after the discovery of nanothermite. Now, as I said earlier, there was a lot of molten metal, molten iron, and extreme heat. There were even droplets found of molten molybdenum. I don't know how you say it in New Zealand, but it's moly. We call it chrome moly. Moly. Molybdenum has one of the highest melting points on the periodic table, and we find in the dust we find small tiny spheres of molybdenum. This means that it was an extremely hot event. If nothing else, the destruction of the World Trade Center was accompanied by temperatures way off the charts, extremely hot, and we know that from the people who were trapped inside the building. You know, before the South Tower collapsed, about 7 minutes before it collapsed, a cascade of molten iron began to pour off the corner of the building where the plane had come out. And it was white hot. It was light yellow and white hot. And it just started to pour off the building. And this is documented by the engineers who wrote the FEMA report. They said that there would be they timed it. They said there would be a puff of white smoke, and then shortly after there'd be a gush of molten metal. And what they're documenting are thermite reactions, because when thermite detonates, or when thermite reacts, it creates aluminum oxide, which is a white smoke. Very typical of what we see in the skies in the chemtrails, aluminum oxide, but it's very, very white. And when you look at the destruction of the World Trade Center, whenever you see a puff of white smoke or a big cloud of white smoke, what you're probably seeing is a thermetic reaction. And then the other product is, of course, the molten metal. And that poured off the building for 7 minutes. For 7 minutes, it was filmed by WABC TV, for example, ABC affiliate in New York City.
That's a shitload and of just, material.
Yeah, that's a lot. And that's right, a good point. And I said, where did they hide that? How did they hide that in that building? And I looked at the floor plan, and there was no explanation what was on floor, I think, 82. And that's where this was coming from. And I finally found out that, you know, the New York Times didn't tell you who was on floor 82. It was Fuji Bank was there, but what was on floor 82? I mean, how do you hide tens of tons of thermite on a floor with secretaries and you know whatnot? Well, it wasn't a normal floor. It was a reinforced floor that had a lot of it was a computer floor. So it had racks and racks of computer servers. And in the summer before, a guy called me who had worked on that floor, and he told me that in the summer before 9/11, at nighttime, they would roll in these big black boxes onto the floor and put them in the floor in the nighttime. I thought that was very interesting. And he said that we were told that these were backup batteries for the computer system in case the power failed. But he said, you know, the strange thing was that they were never plugged in. So that's how they got the tens of tons of thermite out of the floor. Although it's possible that their thermite was on the plane as well. But you see, that's how they had all of this thermite that produced this cascade that fell from the floor. It was tens of tons of stuff because one cubic yard of molten iron weighs like 8 tons. So you're talking about a lot of stuff. And you know, that when they got down to the World Trade Center, after the World Trade Center fell, when they finally got down to the bedrock of Manhattan, when they excavated and got down to the bedrock of Manhattan, they found molten iron in the molten state. This is like a month after the event, and it's still in the molten state. And that was, I learned that from one of the people who were involved in removing the rubble. And it was confirmed by another person who was involved in the general removal of all the rubble, that at the basement of all three towers that fell that day, North Tower, South Tower, and Building 7, there were pools of molten iron. And now I found out recently that I haven't finished this story, but there was at the end of the cleanup period in the summer of 2002, there was a request for a special truck to come down from Connecticut with 50 cubic meters capacity to take away hazardous material. And they took a lot, what's called a live load. They took a load of stuff from the World Trade Center rubble from ground zero. And they took it up to 50 cubic meters of stuff. They took it up to a toxic hazardous waste dump up by Niagara Falls, upstate New York. And there they put it into a special, they treated it, they put it in with concrete probably, and put it in a cell and buried it in the ground in a specific place in this hazardous waste disposal area, which is full of stuff from Manhattan Project. It's full of all kinds of the worst stuff, you know, really toxic stuff. And I know the truck driver. I know the truck driver's name, and I know the executive from the company who went with, a female executive from the company who went with for this one load. And it's like the last load, you could say. It's the last load from World Trade Center. And I thought, the question is, why was it considered hazardous? Was it truly hazardous, or was it the fact that it was perhaps something nuclear, or it was something hardly – I don't think nuclear, but it was something that was so secretive that it had to be classified as hazardous waste so that it would be hidden from the prying eyes of anybody else.
So what does that mean?
Well, it means that up there in this dump in Model City, New York, by Niagara Falls, there is a cell which we know we can find out the name of that cell. I mean that area, and we could extract this material and find out what it is. But that's of course a big undertaking. But you see, right now there is an interest in understanding what happened. The people who are involved. We know who are involved in that shipment, who's involved in the transportation, who's involved in the burying of that stuff. So there are witnesses. We don't have to dig it up. We can talk to the people who are involved in that. The person who ordered the special truck in the first place. The person who decided that this stuff, I think, for example, it might be some of the molten metal that was hardened because you have pools of molten metal, pools of it. And that had to be disposed of. Well, what do you do with it? You can't just send it to the junkyard. I mean, across, to Jersey City, to the normal junkyard, you got a big chunk, I don't know how big, of molten metal that's been hardened. People are going to say, what is this? So you need to dispose of it in a way that people don't see what it is.
Mm. kind of like how all the steel and everything like that got shipped off to China before it was even investigated for fire by fire personnel and all of that kind of stuff, right?
Right. And I closed my book, Solving 9/11, Deception Changed the World. I said, I have to close this book. I have to end this book somehow. And I realized that the destruction of the evidence was the way that I would end it, because that's part of the crime. You see, the destruction of the evidence is, of course, a crime, but we're talking about a very sophisticated crime here. So the people that had to destroy this metal, they had to first destroy it as evidence. Then they had to send it far away to a faraway country where it would be melted down, hopefully by people who are also interested in covering up the crime. And that's what happened. You know, it involves people like Mark Rich. Mark Rich set up the group of people that he sent over, the two guys from these two Jewish diamond guys from Belgium, came over and set up a part of the business who would handle the shipment of the metal from the World Trade Center to China. And, you know, it's interesting that this metal from the World Trade Center was some of the best metal in the world ever made. You know, it was extremely strong stuff. But it had to be destroyed, and it was being destroyed at a time when the price of scrap steel was the lowest it had been in 50 years. So it's kind of bad business to take this metal and ship it halfway around the world to China. It makes no sense. It makes more sense that you would save money on the shipping costs, because they were paying $25 a ton to ship the stuff to China. So they completely ate up the margin.
A lot of people in your position will say, oh, that doesn't make sense. Whereas I think of it kind of like, what would a psychopathic criminal scumbag who's covering shit up do? Oh, that makes perfect sense.
That's right. And it involves some of the actors from, you know, previous scandals. Like, it involves people like Mark Rich and there's a lot of characters I could name that your audience wouldn't understand who they are. They're not well-known names, but maybe since you're out there in Asia Pacific, you've heard of Shaul Eisenberg.
No, no,
Shaul Eisenberg. You know, he was Mr. China. He was the big Zionist mega criminal based in China during World War II, until 1990, whenever he died, and he. He built a building in Tel Aviv called Asia House, because his whole domain was Asia. In fact, it's interesting that during World War II, he was advising the emperor, in their war against the West, against the United States and Europe and whatnot. And in exchange for his help, the Japanese army trained the Betar, the Zionist black shirts, you would say, the Betar. They're the Likud from the Likud party.
And apparently they trained them on mass, and they became mass debaters.
They trained them in terrorism. And then after the war, they went to Palestine, where they applied the terror tactics that they'd learned from the Japanese. This man, Shaul Eisenberg, happens to be the man who owned the company that got the security contract for the World Trade Center in 1987. And he sent over two people who were his representatives in America were two senior Mossad agents, men who had been involved in the smuggling of plutonium, for example, from the United States to Israel. One man's name is Zvi Malkin and Shalom Ben-Dor, Avram Shalom Ben-Dor. And these two men were in their 60s. They'd been involved in all kinds of things, like kidnapping Adolf Eichmann from Argentina, and, as I said, plutonium from Pennsylvania. And they came to America, and they had a company called Atwell Security, which was owned by Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. China. And they got the security contract for the World Trade Center, the terrorism contract for the World Trade Center, in 1987. But when it was discovered by the Port Authority that Mr. Shalom Ben-Dor was using a fake name, and that he'd been involved in murder in Palestine, in Israel, of some Palestinians, they took away the contract. They tore up the contract. They nullified it. Had that not happened, 9/11 probably would have happened in the late 1980s or early 1990s. Mm-hmm. And we would have been at a big disadvantage, because the equalizing thing for us has been the internet. If we didn't have the internet in 2000, 2001, we would have been at a loss, because we would have only been given the story from Time Magazine and New York Times, and that would have been the end of it.
I think that cover-ups have to happen perpetually, essentially. Like, for example, there's still people debating about whether or not JFK was a conspiracy. All right, and somebody said in the chat room, I think it might have been Perth Observer, saying that 9/11's just too bitter a pill for the vast majority of people in the United States to swallow, and that they will never, ever understand it or do anything about it, you know. And I find cynicism to be a remarkably useful tool, especially in the belt of a journalist, because you look at something, you make a cynical assumption about it, and because the people who run the fucking planet are remarkably cynical sons of bitches, your assumption's straight off the bat are often true. Like for instance, I think it was maybe 2012 or something, my wife comes into the room and says, "Baby, there was a truck bomb that they defused in Times Square." And just straight off the bat, not even thinking about it, "Don't worry, baby, it was probably just the FBI." And it was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Every fucking time. And I think maybe that's part of the reason why we go through these depression and anxiety cycles, and then they stop, and they kind of stop permanently, because you become sort of... you become numb to it, much like a soldier who is lashed and lashed and lashed as part of his training. You learn to not feel that pain anymore, and you just operate, bing, you know, that kind of thing. And it's, we need trauma. I think that this is an immutable truth. If you want to do anything of value in society, you need to be traumatized by it, in order to give you not only the strength to endure, but the motivation to do it in the first place, you know? And I think maybe the New World Order understands this principle. That's why they traumatize the fuck out of us with these false flag attempts.
Of course.
So that we keep doing what they're telling us to do.
Of course they do. That's what I was trying to talk about before, when you about trauma and terror. And this has been studied by way back in the... early part of this century, last century, and that by using trauma, by afflicting a population with trauma, you bring them to this childlike state where they're like a quivering mass, and then you can reshape them as you like. This is what was done to Germany, after all. This was also Japan to some degree, but definitely Germany. The firebombing of German cities was meant to bring the German people down to that level where they could reshape them. And create a new Germany, and that's what they've done. That's what they have done that, and it was done through terrorism, sheer terrorism like what Hamburg and Dresden and Berlin. You know, when you reduce these huge cities, big cities, to, you know, ashes, then you and the people are just you've traumatized the people, the population, to such a degree, then you can recreate them the way you want. And as they did to the Germans, they did to the American people. 9/11 was a psychological trauma. Of course, it didn't affect the American people like the firebombing of Germany affected the Germans, but it affected the American people on a psychological level. And then you have to have this expertly prepared narrative and media stories ready to go, because there's something called the primacy effect. You have to get that story, that narrative out there first, while that quivering mass is still quivering. And they're completely vulnerable. And the first explanation that they are given will be the one they take away. Nothing else matters. And that was done by the Israelis. They had a guy called Ehud Barak, the former prime minister and Israel's most highly decorated soldier, chief of staff. He happened to be in London at the BBC studios, BBC World TV. And he sat down, and with his rather rustic English, He explained what we saw that day. He said, we all know who did this. This is Osama bin Laden. And we know where he is. So now is the time for America to start an operational concrete war on terror. That's the message. That was it. And so that explanation was what then the American people took to be the truth. And it has not changed ever since.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because the definition of terrorism is a system of government that threatens and intimidates its population into going along with its fucking agenda. Right. All right. It's a system of government. Communism, fascism, terrorism, you know, it's government. Right, and government itself, governe in Latin means controlling, and mente means the mind. So government literally means mind control. Now, somebody, I think, I'm not sure who it was in the chat room, they asked me if I'd covered the Tavistock Institute on this show. I was wondering if you know much about them.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The Tavistock Institute is British psychological warfare from World War II. And they still operate in Tavistock Square in Britain, in London. And it happens to be the place where the one bust, when they had this, they had the July 5th bombing, I think it was in 2005 in London. They had the subway bombing and the truck bomb, I mean the bus bomb.
7-7, yeah.
Yeah, 7-7. That bus bomb, the bus exploded right outside Tavistock.
And written on the bus was terror on one of the advertisements.
You got it. And at the time, Tavistock Institute was being run in London by an Israeli woman. And that happened to be also the place where Bibi Netanyahu was in London at Tavistock at a hotel when it happened. So the thing is, when 9/11 happened, they had lit the fire. They had lit the big fire, the bonfire of the war on terror, but they needed to throw more logs on it. And that's why they had the Bali bombing, and they had the London bombing, and the Madrid bombing, and other kinds of things have happened. This is to keep the thing going, to kind of like steer the direction, to inflame other populations, like the Australian population. They had to be engaged, so they had the Bali bombing. Hmm. The Spanish needed to be engaged, so they had the Madrid bombing. Even though, you know, again, with each one of these cases, there are clear forensic facts that indicate that the bombs were different from what we've been told. I think it was in London or Madrid. It was very clear, I think maybe in both places, that the bombs had actually been placed under the carriage, under the subway carriage, under the wagon, under the chassis, so that the bomb went off and exploded the floor upwards. You see, it wasn't being done by some kids with backpacks or what have you. No. But it doesn't really matter, because when the average person is told that, maybe the Cretan you're talking about before, that but when the average population is told, the average person is told by the government, by the media, who they trust, that this has been done by radical Islamic terrorists, and here's the pictures of them, that's all you need to say. That's it. And most people will accept that, just like they accept that those streaks in the sky are condensation trails, without any further thinking on their part. They won't question it. They won't take any look at the evidence. They say, the government told me who did it. That's enough. That's all I need to know.
This reminds me of a video done by Baron Cruz. He does this channel, great channel if you guys want to learn how to speak and act in front of people, called the Charisma Matrix. And he did this video about first impressions. Okay, now, if you are a human being and you look at another human being, it takes 0.001 microseconds for you to make a first impression of them. And your first impressions are often very accurate. However, on the occasions when your first impression is not accurate and you learn that you're wrong, you will still go with your first impression 70% of the time anyway. And I thought to myself, fuck, that totally explains why people can be told something completely bullshit or like for example, we have a prime sinister here in New Zealand, daughter of a Freemason, cop, got given a Freemasonic scholarship and then got trained in England to cover up for Freemason investigations and things like that, and then comes back here, joins a whole bunch of globalist clubs, and then boom, she's prime minister, right? And me and my mates who are journalists and shit, we're just laughing our ass off because it's so obvious to us. And then we make a 7-minute video exposing all of this stuff, and then people go, no, but she's going, and they denial. And I thought to myself, wow. So 70% of the people, after that first impression is given, will basically never change their fucking mind. Now, statistically speaking, approximately 30% of people will require some kind of evidence before they start believing something. All right? and approximately 30% of people will believe anything they hear first time, and another 30% of people won't believe anything you tell them, regardless of how much evidence you give them, that kind of thing. So the stats sort of match up to a large degree on there. And so this means essentially, if we are to be successful as a movement, we need to know psych warfare, and we need to deploy those frickin' tactics against people. And we already are. Any false flag that comes out nowadays, Chris, I mean, back in the day when we first started doing this, difficult to expose a false flag at first. Nowadays, they do a false flag, it's exposed in minutes, right? The truth movement's already online. They're already making videos. They're already exposing all the anomalies. And, I wonder if we're having such a greater effect now because of the larger size of the movement or whatever, or if we've been infiltrated or whatever. I don't know where I'm going with this, but...
But it's very true. But the problem is, the thing is that we're lacking is that we're not organized. We're not organized like they are. You see, they, as I said, they're organized. They have money. They have money. They have power, political power. They have everything. They own whole TV networks. And we're seeing now, we're seeing this divide between the independent media like yourself, the truth and the liars. We're seeing that the media in the United States, for example, and in the English-speaking world, are not serving the public at all. They're not providing us with any information. They're lying to us. They're manipulating us to serve their masters, their owners, like the Rothschilds. You know, where did Mr. Murdoch from Australia get all the money to come to the United States and buy 160 newspapers, for crying out loud? You know, the Americans don't know how to run a newspaper. He has to come over as some little guy from Australia and buy up all our newspapers. How does that happen? Where does the money come from? Well, I mean, it's like it comes from the Rothschilds, because controlling the media is how they control the population. So, as you said, it's now come to a point where they've been exposed as all being fake media. They're all fake media. In my mind, since 9/11, any media outlet that protects and promotes the official story is fake media. I'm sorry. What else can you call it?
If I may. 90% of what fake media says is absolutely true. That's how they get you to keep believing in them, because they tell you things that are true mixed in with the bullshit.
That's how disinformation works. That's the essence of disinformation. Mm. You have to, of course, give the public at least 90% truth so that you can always have that 10% to throw a curveball.
That's how Steven Spielberg thought of it, like right at the end of Jaws. Now, anybody who's actually punctured an air tank will know that they don't frickin' explode. They just go tss and shoot off. Okay, so he said that we tried to play the film as realistically as possible, and we had them there for 90% of the movie, and then the last 10% of the movie, I'll just stretch the truth, and because I've had them for so long, they'll believe it anyway. And I thought to myself, whoa, that's a genius filmmaker at the top of his craft. And then it occurs to me, manipulating people is a kind of art, and art changes. Every single time somebody creates a new artwork, it'll inspire new artists and things like that. And I believe that the truth movement is much the same, much like you, Christopher, have inspired many people within the audience, as they've been recounting in the chat, that you're one of the people who's actually connected all these goddamn dots and how much enlightenment you have brought them. And it occurs to me that because of the fact that you're doing such good work and actually really treating it as a craft, more or less, that's the reason why it's become so powerful and inspired so many others, rather than the fake mainstream media and something like that appear to just be populated. Well, according to Ian Wishart, who's a former New Zealand journalist here, the media are just populated by airheads who don't know what they're doing, and that's why it's so easy to see through their deception.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's nice to hear. Because I've always been very, very, very careful. You have to understand that although I've been watching Israeli treachery and crimes for decades, since I went to Israel the first time way back when, I was still very, very careful in what I said. Because, first of all, you don't want to be seen as being anti-Israeli just for the sake of being anti-Israeli. And you know, you have to make sure that you're not pushing something based on a prejudice or a dislike, and that the evidence actually shows what you're trying to say, or what, you know, the evidence actually supports you. And so I treated it as a hypothesis for years. I mean, for the first couple of years, it was completely just a hypothesis that this is possible. It's possible. And I think it was in 2003, I didn't write very much about 9/11 at all, because I was so taken up with the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq had just started, and that was the big story. But then I got, you know, certain years were more productive. You know, a few leads, a few discoveries will lead to more. And I was making so many discoveries at the time that I couldn't keep track of them all. I couldn't pursue all of those leads. I could only, you know, go a certain, whichever way panned out the most. And so a lot of things didn't get investigated. So, you know, but what can you do? I'm only one person. And I thought that by exposing these things to the public would pick up the ball, and there would be people out there who would say, yeah, I'll look into that. I'll look into that. That didn't happen. I was a little disappointed in that. You know, it was I had to do most of it myself. Even people who wanted to help me were simply unable to. Maybe they didn't know how, or didn't know where to dig, or what to ask, or I don't know.
Story of my life.
But I also found out that some of them were working for the other side, of course. But in any case, I persevered, and you know, like sometimes the thing that leads to the biggest break is the thing that hurts you the most. Like, you know, being attacked by these cops and my whole family having to leave my hometown and all that. That was very painful. But you know, these are the things that this work, you know, this is not a small thing we're talking about. We're talking about a very, very, very big thing. We're talking about the biggest event of our lifetime, that has led to this artificial reality, I call it, where we're all involved in this kind of like fear and loathing and warfare against Islamic people. You know, we're waging war. America is waging war in scores of countries right now. They don't talk about it. They have special operations going on from the middle of Africa to the middle of Asia, everywhere, South America. All of it, most of it is being based on the authorization that was given to the president after 9/11, the authorization to use military force, which gives the president the sole discretion, the sole right to send forces wherever he thinks there's a terrorist who's involved in 9/11. And it doesn't matter if it has to do with 9/11 anymore. It's just now it's just the war on terror. It's gone off the rail. And so whether like the people that they're fighting in Syria today have nothing to do with 9/11, never mind, they're terrorists. And that's enough.
It just occurred to me. It's 2019. Children have been born and grown up all the way to 18 years of old without knowing a world that does not have a war on terror. Now, the banana experiment springs to mind. For those of you in the audience who don't know, you got three monkeys sitting in a room, and up the top of a pole in the middle of the room is a bunch of bananas. Monkeys like bananas. They try going for them, but they can't get them because every time one of them tries, they all get sprayed with a freezing cold high-pressure fire hose, and they go, oh, God, I'm not going to go and get those bananas. Then they take out just one of the monkeys that had seen the hose and been sprayed by it, and then they bring one more monkey in. And what that monkey does is he goes for the bananas, and then all of the monkeys get sprayed with water again. So they stop going for the bananas. Then they get out one or more of the monkeys. One more new guy comes in, and as he tries to go for the bananas, the other two monkeys, one of which had never been sprayed by a hose, started to drag him down and beat him up and prevent him from doing it. Right? And then they took out the third monkey, the only monkey that had actually been sprayed with a hose. So now you've got three entirely new monkeys here that had never been sprayed with a hose, never been shown any physical consequences of going for the bananas. And what do? They prevent the other new monkey from going to get the bananas by beating him up. And the lesson herein is that if you are raised to believe something, It doesn't matter if you've even seen it for yourself or experienced it for yourself. You will believe it so blindly that you will attempt to destroy and hurt anybody who attempts to tell you different. Now, isn't that a sad realization? Because now we have children of voting age. And I say the word children of voting age because just because you're old enough to vote does not mean you have grown up, does not mean you have become an adult. And that means that there is now an entire generation walking this earth today who've known nothing but the war on terror, nothing. And that situation's That's right. only ever going to get worse. And I fear for all of our futures.
That's right. Well said. Absolutely right.
Just kind of knocked myself sideways thinking about that one. Now, I've got a question for you.
That's very true. Very true.
How do we know if someone's working for the other side? Because you let's not mention names because often that always gets us a shitload of trouble.
Right.
I want to actually explain something to people. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, you know why Chris is on the show? It's because he's not working for the fucking New World Order. Okay. So. Right, so a lot of people have encouraged me, oh, why don't you get this member of the New World Order, that member of the New World Order, and, like, ask them tough questions and shit like that, because I get on their fucking radar and they fuck my life sideways. That's why! Okay? And now, but if you get somebody who knows what the fuck they're talking about and has shown themselves over years and years and years to have integrity that they will not abandon... It means that you are helping the entire human race in the aggregate by giving those people a goddamn platform. And I wish people would realize that you need to be listening to different people's opinions all the goddamn time. If they're all credible, so much better. But again, the question, I think maybe even somebody in the chat room offered this, or it might have been one of my own, but how do we know if someone's working for the other side? I mean, just take the 9/11 truth movement, for example. Mm-hmm. You talked about red herrings and inflating those kind of things, but how do we know?
That's a very good question. For me, personally, it's pretty easy. I mean, at least when we're talking about people who are detractors, like people who are attacking me. Because I personally know that I have integrity, like you said, thank you. You're welcome. I know I only work for myself. I'm only one person. I know that I'm honest. So if somebody attacks me without a real reason, then I immediately put a yellow flag or a red flag on that person because there's no reason to attack me. And what I will often do, I'll look into their background, their file, their CV, and find that they are in fact working for the other side, you know, for whatever reason. The other thing is there's the yellow flag crowd. They're the ones who you can't be sure of, but who come into the 9/11 movement, for example, and rather than look for the truth or, you know, be polite and kind and seek the truth, they are attacking other people. They're attacking this guy or that guy or this guy. They're sowing dissent, or they're coming up with a theory and they're saying this theory is the only explanation. You other guys are full of it, and. You know, that's what we see in the 9/11 movement. We see a lot of that, that kind of divide and conquer. And there's a reason for this, is that, like you said before, the OSS learned this trick back in the 40s, I guess. When you have a group of people like the 9/11 Truth Movement, the way that you really disarm them, you weaken them, is that you spread these deceptions, these lies, and these red herrings, and these alternative theories, so that you have the public, the consumer becomes tired of thinking about it. It's you have the dissent. You say Chris Bullin is saying this, that Judy Wood is saying that, Dmitry Kolosov is saying that, and they get tired of it, and they give up. They just walk away. A lot of people leave the movement. I've seen in Los Angeles, you create division in the group about a theory, or whether it's this group or that group, and then the group disbands. People lose interest. They quit. They don't want to be. Americans don't want to be involved in something where there's disagreement, where there's people that are making a lot of noise and being unpleasant. People say, forget about it. I don't need this in my life. And so then there's no 9/11 Truth Group in Los Angeles, California, in the nation's media capital. There is no 9/11 Truth Group, and it hasn't been one for 7 years now.
Perfectly.
Imagine.
Perfectly destroyed.
New York, and what you find is that you find in many of the 9/11 Truth Groups, they're controlled by a small group of people at the top, a steering committee, if you will, and they only allow certain points of view to be discussed. And of course, I am not invited to many of these groups because the steering committee of the group does not approve what I have to say. Northern California Truth Alliance is one example. They will not allow me to speak at their September 11th powwow because they don't want it. I'm not welcome. They did have a private event. They had a separate event for me, you know, a few months later, you know. But I'm not allowed to be invited to their main event. And this is you know, this happened in many places across America, because you know, you have to have control of this, such a movement. The 9/11 Truth Movement has immense power. If it's applied correctly, if we're organized, if we were to work together properly, we could accomplish a lot. That's why I'm thinking about starting some sort of foundation where I could get some more leverage. Because you know, as a single individual, I can't do much except my writing and my research. But there has to be some sort of vehicle to take this movement to the next step. To put political pressure, to have a larger voice. And that's what we're missing. That's what we're missing right now.
I was thinking a couple of things there. Dirty politics stop people getting involved, and also counter propaganda, more or less. I'll just explain these. So in 2008, a New Zealand journalist named Nikki Hager released a book called Dirty Politics. And essentially what it did is it chronicled a US election and how New Zealand's electioneers copied that exact same system in order to achieve victory here. Now, how dirty politics works is precisely as you said. If you've got two people saying complete opposite things and they're getting angry at each other and just name-calling and shit like that, any reasonable or intelligent person would go, fuck this, all right, and they're out, you know, that kind of thing. So what happens is, though, you get idiots who are aggressive and have personality disorders love that shit and can't get fucking enough of it. And so they start pouring in and going harder and harder and harder, while all the moderates, everybody who wants to see evidence, everybody who wants a reasonable debate, everybody who wants a better future, falls by the wayside. And what that does is it means that those people and their lower level of consciousness become the domineering factor. Every single election suddenly makes sense. Okay, what's the outcome of every single election? Well, a new world order puppet gets elected and the fucking agenda continues. Oh, is that possibly a side effect of not having any goddamn intelligent people who actually want facts, evidence, and don't want to make it about personality and emotion and dirty politics? How did this happen? And that's fucking how it happened. And I believe that the exact same phenomenon exists within every single movement. They'll get infiltrated. They'll turn into, just as you've described.
That's right.
And I think that the last point I wanted to make here is countermeasures. Okay, so if they do infiltrate and things of that nature, how do you deploy countermeasures against them? I mean, I've managed to do it on a micro scale here on this channel. You create an abusive comment or something like that. You ain't got no evidence to justify. No warning, blocked. You're gone. And it's the same on my Facebook as well. Same kind of thing. If you're using these dirty politics tactics, you're blocked. You're fucking gone, so I never have to deal with you, and neither do the rest of my audience. Because if you allow those people within your chat rooms, within your discussions, they will poison everybody who is reasonable and intelligent there. And I think that having quite a ruthless efficiency within this is really the only way to actually prevent places from becoming infiltrated, because there's so many well-meaning people in this world who think, oh, everybody can just get along if we're all just honest and stuff like that. It's like, no. There are bad people. There are people who are insane. There are people who have personality disorders. There are people who are just fucking stupid and annoying. All right. And you don't need to give them immense amounts of rope. All right. You only need enough to hang them with. And usually they'll just expose themselves. All right. So you say the word controversial doesn't mean what a lot of people think it means. What it actually means is that you are confronted with a truth that will force you to change what you are doing with your life. That is the word controversial in a nutshell. And if you have people who are too weak or too bitter to swallow that truth pill and make a change in their life, keep them the fuck out of the movement. All right, because they're not going to benefit it in any way. And I think we do need to be far more ruthless. Now, the New World Order has, as you pointed out before, they've got secrecy, they've got power, they've got funding and things of that nature. And of course, as we've seen when we go out public and in the media and things like that, there'll be certain tactics deployed against us, certain countermeasures to destroy us, to discredit us, to traumatize us, make us escape from our homelands, these kind of things. What if we were to create, and this is something I've been talking out with a couple of ex-Freemason friends of mine, what if we were to create a sort of secret order and stuff like that and only allow in people that have proven their worth, you know, that kind of thing. Now, the one inherent problematic part of that is that we're all under surveillance, and the NSA PRISM system is designed specifically to look for communications that are trying to conceal themselves. So we can't do it publicly because too many people were involved, and we can't do it privately because we'd get found out and destroyed. It's a fucking conundrum.
Yeah, we have to do it openly. That's the thing, is that secrecy, secret groups are secret for a reason. They're secret because they're doing bad things. And it's like, it's kind of like anathema, or it's not something. But the good doesn't need to be secret. The good needs to be is open. The truth doesn't have to be hidden behind under a bushel or anything like that. You know, that's the thing, is that we have, because we're truthful, we have the ability to be completely open about what we're doing, and of course that makes it harder for us, because you know the bad guys see what we're doing and can cut us off at the pass or whatever. But I think that the openness of the internet has, you know, and that good people can recognize another good person. They recognize the goodness in people. The bad guys, you know, their secrecy is for a purpose, because they are doing evil things, and the evil power requires secrecy in order to do what it does. We have to fight it openly, I think. I can't see how good people would be so secretive while doing good. It's almost like it doesn't fit together.
You're right in a lot of ways there, because the old saying, and I think this applies to a lot of things, but particularly to evil. You can't go into a room that is full of light and bring darkness into it. Light chases away the darkness, and this is honesty versus lies and deception. And I think that is absolutely true, because as soon as you bring a dishonest person into a completely honest environment, everybody just goes, "I don't like this guy anymore, bro. Let's get him the fuck out of here." That kind of thing. And this even happened in a political party that I was involved with, and it's interesting to see that if you tell the truth and you go, this guy's a dick, okay, this guy's causing dissent within the group, this guy is not on board with the truth, let's get him the fuck out of here. Now, it does actually take a lot of effort to convince someone to abandon a human being. You know, it's... And make no bones about it, ladies and gentlemen, many human beings within this world must be abandoned. They are wounded, they are dangerous, and they must be left behind. Otherwise, they're going to slow everybody up. That's exactly the same in a military operation. If you want to slow down your enemy, lay shitloads of traps everywhere. Because that way, every single time somebody sets off a trap, the entire battalion is slowed down. Because you have to carry the wounded, right? And this is working psychologically, I think, by the New World Order against the people. We've become so psychologically wounded and traumatized by so many of the things that we've done to us that we're slowing everybody else down. And I think maybe sometimes we have to realize that the best thing we can do is bow out and stop getting in people's fucking way. And it's a dark realization that I've had to come to over time, is that most people in this world, possibly 90% of them, will never want to sacrifice everything of value that they have in order to protect everything of value for everybody else. And that, make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, this is what we are doing. We understand that we will lose everything, including our lives, money, freedom, whatever. It doesn't really matter. If freedom and life and liberty do not fucking exist in the future, what justification do we have for not fighting for a better future today? And the answer is, there is no justification. But it takes trauma to come to that realization. One of my listeners, I think maybe even the first year of my show, asked me, Vinny, my family doesn't agree with me about the drug war. They think it's a good thing or whatever. What do you think I should do to convince them? And I said, well, have you tried placing a false call to the cops and saying that they've got drugs on them? Because guaranteed, when the cops come into your house for no fucking reason and shoot your dog and tear everything the fuck apart and beat the shit out of you and taser you and they find nothing and get away with it, your belief in the war of drugs evaporates. Just like that. Okay? Just like it did to me. And I think, frankly, Is there even a moral justification for traumatizing our fellow human beings just to get them to wake up to the pain of the truth? They have to volunteer, isn't it? That's what we go through with military training. They tell us they're going to break you down and they're going to create something else. And they repetitively traumatize you into that shit. But that doesn't make you a free person. That makes you a goddamn slave. And it's so hard to strike that balance between how do you create somebody who is free and understands the value and the reason and what it is that they're doing versus how do you just traumatize somebody to the point where they shut off and become a slave? Is it down to the individual or is it down to the techniques you use? I don't know. It's a lot of complex shit there. A lot to think about. But, yeah. Sorry, I do that from time to time. Regardless, you said you'd probably only give us 1 hour. It's been 2 and a quarter. You must be sleepy as shit. So, Chris, if you wouldn't mind, please give us a little bit of self-promotion to round off the show, and then I'll ask the listeners for some donations on my behalf. So go righty.
Okay, well, thank you. My website is my last name, bollyn.com, bollyn.com. And my books are called Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And the companion book in the set is called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles, which contains all the articles written in the first 11 years in chronological order. And the third book is The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East. And I'm offering this to readers, the complete set for $50 US. And to Australia and New Zealand, I usually ask another $15 for shipping and handling because it's all the books are printed in England. It still is a little bit higher cost. But donations can be made to me by PayPal at bollyn@bollynbooks.com or through my website. There's a donation button on the side. And I urge people that if they're interested in understanding the War on Terror, to at least get a copy of the little book, The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East, because understanding that we've been hoaxed, we've been tricked into this war for the past 17 years, and that this war is destructive of everything that we, as Vinny said, everything that matters, it's really important. So I made the War on Terror book very small. It's a very small and concise read. You can read it in a few hours and share with your friends, because the only way we can get out of this deception, the only way we can free ourselves from this enslavement, is to understand the deception, who's behind it, and why it's being done. And it's it's a very liberating thing to understand that we've been lied to, and to finally be able to understand who's behind it. And so I thank you very much, Vinny. It's been a pleasure. And it was really interesting listening to you.
I get that a lot. Now, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening as well. Now, I do want to get across one particular thing. I forgot to do it at the beginning of the show. I'm currently raising money for a new car. Ladies and gentlemen, I asked for some donations around about this time yesterday. Within 1 hour, I had half of the amount of money that I needed to raise. By this morning, we had 75% of the amount of money raised. We only need another $200, and then I've got myself a new car. And I am so grateful for all of you that have donated and have decided to help me out in this particular situation. And also, I want to actually make it very clear, ladies and gentlemen, every time I ask for money from you, I feel so guilty about it. Like, oh my God. I was just like, oh God, what am I doing? Why can't you do something of value, Vinny, you know, with your life? I mean, I consider myself not a talk radio show host, but a talk radio show parasite. So ladies and gentlemen, please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood. Like, go ahead, make my news, and go ahead, make a donation. Whether you are going to be following me monthly through the Patreon, which you can, and you get access to a whole bunch of new things before they come out, as well as anybody who has donated in the past. And I give this as a carte blanche offer. If you've donated to me in the past, doesn't matter whether it's $1, $100, whatever, just email me and ask me for the donor rewards, okay? And you'll get them. In fact, you can just go to the homepage of the VinnyEastwoodShow.com, and there'll be a little section there that says, have you already donated? Click here to get your rewards. Click on it, you'll get your rewards. 100 videos that are unlisted on my channel, because the people who I interviewed on those videos asked me not to share them, except with people that I trust. And if you're giving the Vinny Eastwood Show money, that kind of shows that you're worthy of trust somewhat, ladies and gentlemen. So I want to thank each and every one of you who has donated thus far. And today was the most successful Super Chat day that we've had on this channel. We had 3 total Super Chats from you guys, and I am extraordinarily grateful for every single one of you over the whole course of my 10-year career, just letting me keep doing my job, which is to try and prevent the subsequent enslavement and extermination of the human race. You know, so it's a tough job. So, yes, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Love you all. And thank you, Chris, for spending some time of your extraordinary middle-of-the-evening sacrifice here.
Thank you, Vinny.
Hope you enjoyed yourself.
It's been a pleasure.
I get that a lot. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, catch you later.